This is the ETH Podcast, and I'm your host, Jennifer Kakshuri. In this episode, I'll be talking to ETH Rector Sarah Springman and to Professor Manu Kapoor. We're going to talk about talent, a topic that is debated on the international stage in the context of colleges and universities, and also at the Times Higher Education World Academic Summit hosted by ETH Zurich in September 2019. Sarah Springman, you're the rector of the ETH and professor of geotechnical engineering. What talent brought you here to ETH?
I think an ability to combine the theory behind soil mechanics and geotechnical engineering. So that's sort of a bit like making sandcastles and being able to produce the equations to explain why they stand up on a larger scale, to also being able to lead people, lead groups, be creative, have ideas, spot opportunities, and then actually run with that. And I think also an attention to detail on trying to work out how I sell the idea of a female engineer, civil engineer, coming to ETH to potentially become the first civil engineering professor female in Switzerland.
Manu Kapoor, as a professor, were you more diligent or were you talented to become what you are today?
Well, I never wanted to become a professor in the first place. My first love, as Sarah very well knows, was nothing to do with academics. It was football. And even, if I were to answer that question in that context, it's both. I mean, you have to have a little bit of talent, but that requires a lot of diligence, persistence, struggle. You've got to work hard at it. So it's a bit of both.
So talent consists of very many different things. But When did both of you for the first time realize that you had a talent in doing something?
Oh, goodness. Well, I can tell you what I knew I didn't have. I knew I was never going to be a ballet dancer. I knew I was never going to be a climber or a weightlifter. And I think that puts everything in perspective when you suddenly realize, hey, I can do that. And so you spot opportunities where you feel motivated, passionate, enthusiastic, and where you can actually achieve something. So I'm absolutely somebody who loves to achieve. And in the old days, it was really important that people recognize, particularly my parents, and then said, well done. When you become older and more relaxed about it and your self-esteem goes up, you don't need that anymore. So I think it's a gradual process. And what's fascinating, even as rector, I'm still discovering some areas where I think I might have a little bit of talent and
like
trying
what?
To work on it. I think bringing groups together, pragmatically trying to solve problems, learning a little bit more about public speaking, also in multiple languages, and using these opportunities to try and be able to be not just a cheerleader for ETH, but also to make changes for the future.
What about you, Manu? When did you realize that you have a certain talent?
I think I was just pottering along as a student in primary school, and in grade six, I still remember that was the first time. It was a physical education lesson, and the PE teacher had us play football. And after that one session of football, he said, Manu, you should come and train with the team. And within half a year, I was playing for the high school team in sixth grade. So that was the first time I thought I had something that I can offer, that I can develop. And from that point onwards, it was just football all the way. And then I was lucky. I mean, even though I broke my knee, you know, I found some other things to work with. So, yeah.
So both of you also have an athletic background, so to say. Mm-hmm. Sarah, you were a triathlete. And Manu, you were a professional soccer player until you had an accident. How much of the competitiveness and the talent you had in that field nourished the talent that you have for what you do today?
I think at one level, it's at a very general level. I mean, you know what it means to singularly focus and try to achieve something and work towards your goals. And I think that's something that stays with you. It has stayed with me in everything that I've done, be it after football into doing a startup or teaching and then finally in research. So I think that's the single, I would make that the highlight of the thing that really transfers across from athletics to any other area of life.
And I remember in that context doing some sort of lifetime goals that I might have and breaking it down to in the Olympic scenario, it's a 4-year and then a 1-year and then different phases during the year of what I was going to do and what my priorities were, what were my A priorities out of the whole list that I wrote down, and therefore what action I was going to take to try and achieve that A priority. And if you were within a week, you had to do it on one of the days of that week and so on. And so that really helped me to focus on the goals that I had and to use my modicum of talent combined with, as Manu said, a lot of hard work. And I work incredibly hard to try, and I practice and I practice and I try and do deliberate, what you might call expert practice, although you wouldn't have called it that years ago, really to try and do it well so that I'm really able to repeat that time and time again if needed. So that if I'm doing something, I know when I've made a mistake, but the people listening to me or watching me don't necessarily see it. And that's what happens when you do deliberate practice. And I think that's a very important part of it as well.
Yeah, I think another feature that, as I heard Sarah talking about practicing and hard work, what you transfer also is this ability to work towards your maximum capacity or right at the edge. And if you're there, sometimes you fail, sometimes you struggle, but you learn to pick yourself up again. But knowing that you can push yourself to that capacity, or finding where that line is, and sometimes even crossing it, I think that transfers into what we do today as well.
As an engineer, I can give you an analogy. We talk a lot about stress and strain, so we know how to compute that. And we talk about the point where everything is elastic. So we've been there and done it. It's all reversible. You know, we're not terribly stressed by it. And we get to a point where we've never been before. And that's called the yield locus. And I can promise you that you have a very different multidimensional yield locus when you become rector, because you haven't done these things before. And then when you've experienced that and you come back inside your yield locus again, it's all I did that before. And when you do it again, it's not such a problem. So I think, and sometimes when you get close to the yield locus, you also get very close to failing, and you have to be ready to do that and then pick yourself up and dust yourself down. And if you've made a mistake, acknowledge that, and then try and put it all right.
Why is failure so important? I mean, you have created this term of productive failure. Why is it important for all of us and for students and for researchers to fail?
Well, innovation, creating new ideas or idea entrepreneurism happens at the edge. And if you're not exploring the edge consistently and widely, you wouldn't fail. Or conversely, the only way you know that you're at the edge, really looking at cutting-edge ideas or cutting-edge performance in any field, is that you have a healthy dose of failure in it. You know, sometimes when people bring projects or you visit labs and say, oh, how many projects do you have? And they say, we have 10, 15 projects, and they're all successful. Well, you know, yes, if they're all successful, that means you're not pushing the edges very much. So I think failure is not just a motivational thing or an inspirational thing. It's actually a metric that you can use both personally in groups and in institutions to say, okay, how much are you pushing the boundaries, the capacities and the performance? And I think that's why failure is important.
So let's speak about students. What kind of talent do students need today in this time and age to succeed at ETH Zurich?
Well, I think they need to have a certain intellectual capacity, because if they don't, they're not going to be able to pick up and run with the ideas that we present them. We want them to have the ability to have basically build a fundamental foundation of basic science and mathematics, because we are a technical university. We do tons of analysis. We synthesize it. We pull it all together. And we want people who can have that so-called T in the education for talent, but T also looked at in terms of having a broad base of understanding around the area that you're particularly interested in, and then a deep dive down the T, so that you really have specific expertise in a particular area. So when you put all of the T's together, all of the talents at ETH together, they are able to take on a problem of global significance, and bringing in their expertise help to try and push the boundaries and come up with a solution.
So do you have a prototypical student for ETH, like an idea for one of them?
No, I think the diversity of backgrounds from which people come is just as important as talent. Talent has to be diverse, you know. So we have the talent, we have the T, and I think you have to have the transfer as well. Yes. So you can have deep foundational knowledge, you can have the personality, and then you'll have to be able to transfer what you have to novel situations, to complex problems. And I think from a learning scientist point of view, research has shown that that link, the transfer to complex problems, to novel situations, to work, to life, is a very big hurdle for students.
So is diversity important also because people come from different school backgrounds, for example, that they bring different talents or different, they were educated in a different way?
So different cultural backgrounds, different physical abilities. Somebody sitting in a wheelchair is going to be looking at solving a problem in a completely different way. Mm. And sometimes they come up with brilliant solutions. And you think, oh, gosh, why didn't I? Well, the reason why I didn't think about it is because I don't face that challenge. Mm. And that's why we are a melting pot for students from very many nations. We are completely open to that. The only thing is they have to be talented and have shown that they have the intellectual capacity. Mm. And I'd like to add on to that a bit too. IQ is one thing. EQ, emotional intelligence, is also, I think, very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you teach here as well?
Well, that's something you can't really teach. You can teach knowledge explicitly, but things like EQ and social interaction and the ability to work together with other people of diverse backgrounds, that's not something you teach, but you create environments within which these things naturally happen. You know, so kinds of project work, internships, getting people together to solve design problems.
ETH Week, for example.
ETH Week. What do you do at ETH Week? For people who don't know?
Well, we have about 200 students from all of our departments, and they come together for a whole week and they work on a so-called problem of global importance. So we've done five of them, or we've done four, and we have another one coming up imminently. Food, water, manufacturing for the future, energy matters, and this time it's all about mobility. Mm. And the lovely thing about this is they do a bit of research at the beginning, and then unlike any other teaching here, they decide the question they're going to answer. And then they work in a team and they do some design thinking, and this is a very, very emotional and intense experience. And then they decide what question, and they try and solve it, and they present it at the end. And the atmosphere is absolutely incredible. And many students have written to me to say the most important experience they had actually was doing this ETH Week. And they're still in touch with friends that they made then. And sometimes they take the idea that they came up with and they take it into the hatchery in the student project house and they work on that, and maybe at some stage in the future there will be a startup. So I think that's really, really quite interesting and fun.
Now imagine if we could do that more and more, and that's my push in the curriculum, right? So if you do more and more of that within the constraints of what's possible in a higher education context, obviously, but the more we do that, I think the greater the development of those kinds of skills we will have.
So what does ETH do to attract talents, not only students, but also researchers? Maybe we can ask you, how were you attracted to ETH, Manu?
Well, I actually had the opportunity in 2014. I was invited to give a talk here by my colleague Elspeth Stern. And then we kept in touch, and at a certain point, ETH had this professorship that opened up, and it was one of the first professorships in learning sciences in higher education. So I was just naturally very attracted to it, and yeah, the rest is history.
And we were absolutely thrilled, actually. So this sort of coincided a little bit with when I became rector, and this is amazing. We're going to learn so much, and we're looking forward to it. And every time I listen to Manu, I think, so many things to do, but we're very, very interested in working together. I think the most important thing for me as a member of the executive board is that if you attract and then choose the right professors, they will create their ecosystem around their group. And that means the scientists and engineers that they employ and the doctoral students and the postdocs who then come in. And at the same time, if they're outstanding in research, also that they really bring their skills into the teaching as well, so that the teaching is based on modern research, really very uplifting and exciting, as well as all the basics that we have to learn. And that these people then will have a massive influence throughout our university, because basically it runs on the professors, but everybody's important, and everybody has to have talents and bring their talents to the team, and they're all multidimensional and variable and whatever, and we need all of them in these diverse teams to help us succeed.
Yeah, and I would say that as a researcher coming in, one of the things that's really been wonderful here is, you know, the amount of trust that's given, the autonomy, the infrastructure, both financially and otherwise, the ecology within which you do your work is just amazing. And I think that those are good ways to attract people.
Students are interesting because we are within the Swiss educational system, which means that anybody who goes to the gymnasium and earns their matura has the right to come and study at ETH and any other Swiss university in whatever they want to do, which is a bit of a challenge for them and us. So we don't really attract people so much at the bachelor level. Maybe 14% come from other countries, but they have to be competent in German.
And they have to take an exam.
And they have to take an entrance exam, and that's important. Roughly 50% pass, by the way. And at master, however, it's a different thing. And here, these rankings that have developed have had a massive impact on making the students aware of what ETH has to offer. And so we've had massive increases in applications. It goes up 5 or 10% every year. And so the departments have to make the decision about which of those students they will make an offer to. And then after that, the students will decide whether or not they want to come.
So that means that you find super talents that apply for the ETH and then you choose them and they then decide to come or not. So it's
yes.
A bit of a complicated...
It's very complicated because the super, super, super duper talents will have applied to lots of different top universities. And a lot of it will depend on whether they get a scholarship. So we have our marvelous excellence scholarship and opportunity program, for example. We have master scholarship program to help support those students.
Yeah, because speaking about diversity, it's not that easy to live and pay rent and
pay food
and tuition in Switzerland.
So all of those things are part and parcel of the picture that a student will be painting about a particular place. And then they will make their decision. And the yield of offer to people coming is often can be ranging depending upon which you're studying, anything from 30% to 60%, for example. But the Swiss students have the right to come here if they come from another university, and the Fachhochschule or the University of Applied Science students are allowed to come if they do some extra credits, anything between 30 to 60 credits to fill up the gaps to make sure that they're also ready and able to complete their masters here.
So what does ETH do to win those super talents that applied to many different schools? How does ETH keep up in the competition?
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I get lots of emails about, I can help you with all of these students and you have to do all of this and pay us. We don't actually need to do anything.
Okay.
And we're very clear about communicating what we offer, and it seems to just happen. And the growth is amazing. We now have 21,000 students, and actually this is a big challenge because we want to make sure that we retain a very strong focus also on our Swiss students, because we are well supported by the Swiss taxpayer. This is a incredibly important to us. But we'd love to mix them with talented students from other countries. And what's absolutely fascinating is that when you look at the statistics of the marks that people get at the end of the master's, are Swiss students who have done their bachelor's at ETH map absolutely on top of the students who come from other countries. So what we can say is getting a bachelor at ETH and going through our selection exams and is fantastic also for the future of Switzerland. But then when we match it with talent from outside, this is also great. And in 2 years, we have a program where they've got up and running. They're as good as our graduates, but also diverse.
Yeah, I think students talk to each other, right? So part of the circle of how people get to a good place or come to universities like ETH is, you know, the word spreads around that you're getting a very good learning experience, and that is relevant. And to the extent that the learning experience at ETH is relevant to their work and life, I think more students would apply. And I think that's implicitly or is what is happening.
Especially with Manu's work now about the student-centered teaching, even more so, then we are evolving. We're not standing still. We're not saying we were once wonderful. We realize that we have to move with the times. And there are all sorts of very interesting new educational models. And so if we don't do that, then we're not living up to the promise that we should be.
So is it different to be a student today, or is it very different to be a student today than 30 years ago at ETH?
Well, I didn't study at ETH.
Neither did I.
Not 30 years ago, so I don't know what ETH was 30 years ago. I think in some sense, yes, it is very different. The competition, just the sheer amount of content, because in 30 years, science has progressed a lot and they need to know a lot more. And like I said, the competition is much greater. The pressures on them are a lot greater with the new media and social media. So I think being a teenager or a student today is probably a lot harder than it used to be when I was a teenager or when I was in school.
And so, people are watching you too, so you can't get away with quite as much as
exactly.
Possibly
you mean as
we
a professor
did, we did then no as a student.
Yeah.
And I came here nearly 23 years ago, so it's not quite the 30 years you talked about, but it was very Herr Professor Doctor. It was very sort of, if I say Germanic, it's not meant to be rude, but it was, and it was like very formal. And I came from a completely laid-back group in Cambridge where we called the professor by his first name, even though he was kind of the Einstein of soil mechanics. It's a bit of a joke there, of course, one stone. And it was a very, very different environment and atmosphere. And that has changed enormously over the years as we've moved from having, at that time, probably about 40% foreign professors, of which the vast majority came from Germany or German-speaking countries. And nowadays, 70% foreign professors, of which a vast number have come back to Europe or have come to Europe from the United States. Completely different and very interesting, very dynamic.
Yeah.
More from Asia, too.
Yeah. Another trend that's happened over the past 20, 30 years is the increasing structuring of the learner's experience, all the way from kindergarten. You know, there used to be a focus on free supervised play, but free play in which children could, you know, tinker around and be bored as well, to the primary school where it wasn't still as structured as it is today. So I think there's this increasing structuring of the learning and life of young students, which as you grow and mature into an adult, you need this freedom, a certain amount of freedom to be who you want to be, to realize who you are. And I think there's a danger that, and I think we're beginning to realize as well in a lot of systems, that this is perhaps detrimental all the way from young to now to the development of young people and talent development in general.
Mm-hmm. There was a lovely statement, let them eat dirt. and let them fall over and scuff their knees and fail and pick themselves up and keep going. All of this stuff that you did, that if you didn't kill yourself or damage yourself badly, then nobody was watching and you could get away with all sorts of exciting things. And that was an important part of childhood, I think, at least in my time.
Absolutely.
So one question about learning and about talent, skills and knowledge, mm-hmm. in what balance should that be if you're talking to someone who is, let's say, 15 years old and is bored with school and wants to change the world? How important is it to have the knowledge and to be skilled?
Well, skills and knowledge to me are just analytical dichotomies. To do anything great or even good, you need both. Yeah. If you want to drive a car well or you want to swim well, in learning sciences, in research, we talk about knowing that, knowing how, and knowing why. And this roughly map onto knowledge and skills. So knowing that to drive a car, you need to do A, B, C, D, E is necessary, but not sufficient. You still need to know how to drive a car. But if you really want to be a brilliant car designer or a scientist, you need to know why the underlying mechanisms work the way they work. So I don't buy into this knowledge-skills divide as much. What I buy into are creating learning environments where the coupling between knowledge and skills, knowing that, knowing how, knowing why, are so tightly coupled that whatever they do, whatever they experience in that environment actually makes them learn deeper, and then that transfers better to novel situations as well.
I think this is exactly why the extracurricular projects like Swiss Loop, where they're building a capsule that whizzes through a vacuum and mm-hmm. accelerates and breaks down, and indeed the Formula Electric, where they're doing the driverless version where the racing car goes around the circuit and picks up hints using sort of semi-remote sensing and then learns to drive that as fast as possible, or building a concrete canoe and racing it. I'd say our students are lousy at the racing bit, but they're jolly good at the technical stuff. And they all come back and they win things. Or iGEM, which is a biological machine that they build and they compete against each other. And when they put themselves under self-imposed pressure with a sort of competition where they all have to be performing on that day at that moment, the amount of learning is absolutely amazing. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it's what they call a flop. But actually, even when you've so-called flopped, you've learned an awful lot. And I think this is a tremendous part of what we can offer at ETH now. And we support and encourage people to do this, in that we do not say, you have to finish your bachelor in 3 years, you have to finish your master in 1.5 to 2 years, which is absolutely lousy for our performance in the rankings. But I don't care, as rector, because the learning experience that the students gain from this is absolutely invaluable.
So we've been speaking about talent and about all the good sides of it and the competition and going to your edges and whatever, but is there also a downside?
Mental health. All universities have a growing challenge with mental health. In fact, probably we could say in society as a whole, we have a growing problem with mental health. And we have to find ways in which we can help people to support other people. And we have structures in place and systems in place if somebody gets to the stage that they're starting to go out of balance. So we have people who don't succeed in their studies, we have an advisory system, we have a joint psychological advisory service with the University of Zurich, the students have a sort of a helpline where you can call, etc. So there's a whole range of this, but it's something we need to look at again, because our recent student survey organised by the Student Association identified that this is continuing to ramp up. And I think that is a challenge. And I hope that each individual, part of our ETH family, will keep an eye around them and, if necessary, put a proverbial arm around their neighbour and say, can I help?
Which brings us back to EQ in a sense also. Mm-hmm.
So the other, the challenge, I would think of it as a challenge rather than a downside, is the problem of equity. When you thinking about developing talent, not everybody, if there's no equity in opportunities that people have, then I think that's you're basically any nation or any institution is underdetermining what it can do with the human resources that it has. So I think that's a huge challenge that we have to solve, of equalizing the opportunity across a multidimensional scale, be it gender, be it cultural background, and so on and so forth. Because what we often don't talk about in talent is also the role of luck.
To be at the right place at the right time.
Now, I know luck favors the prepared, and preparation is a function of opportunity, and that's where equity becomes incredibly important. And I think we need to acknowledge that and do something about it.
So ETH brings out very superb research and very talented students and professors. And one side of the excellence of ETH is also that industry is interested in people who are very good researchers. So each of you now have 30 seconds for a slogan, why people should stay here at ETH and not go to industry or to other schools.
I think if you've got to decide if you're in the business of knowledge creation. I consider myself to be, I'm an entrepreneur of ideas. And I love working with ideas and ideas that can change systems in the world, perhaps. Then being in a good ecology of research as ETH offers is one of the best things you can do.
And I think if you're given an opportunity, for example, to do doctoral studies here, you have to work out whether you're going to be able to work with and learn from and help this professor also to discover all sorts of new things. So it's your personal choice. And actually, maybe it means you should go away from ETH and come back later. Mm-hmm. So I think that's also important to say.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Manu. This was Rector Sarah Springman and Manu Kapoor from ETH Zurich here in the ETH studio at the main building of the university. We talked about talent today on the occasion of the Times Higher Education World Academic Summit hosted by ETH Zurich in September 2019 under the title How Talent Thrives. My name is Jennifer Kakshuri. I produced this episode together with Thies Wachter's Audio Story Lab, sound design Luki Fretz. Thanks for listening.